What would I hear if I was in your head? How many times would I hear you be in judgment of yourself and your actions and who you are? Which is a really sad place to be.
It becomes a language that you live by. If you always think, I got to hit this next goal, or if I'm a failure, then what you're always going to say internally is that I feel like a failure. A great practice, if this could help your audience, we do our morning meeting. And every day in our morning meeting, everyone has to say two things they're grateful for. Because we know that if you're grateful, you're going to release oxytocin. I don't believe there's a subconscious mind.
Hang up now. This goes against everything that I was taught growing up on the ashram.
Let's see if I can debunk it for you.
Dr. Rewire, welcome to Rooted in Wellness. I'm so thrilled to have you on today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, what you do is just so important to so many aspects of living your best life. So we're going to dive into so much of that today. But before we get started, so you know, this podcast is all about ancient wisdom in our modern world and ultimately how we can become more rooted. This is part of your conversation and helping people kind of unlearn certain behaviors. But I would love to know, for you as a practitioner, what are three things that help you feel really, really rooted in your life and your health and your happiness?
That's a great question. I think for me, knowing who I am was the biggest thing I had to learn. Really understanding, okay, who is Alok? Like Dr. Rewire, yeah, but who is Alok? I think I've been on this journey maybe since I was 7 years old trying to figure out who is Alok. So once I figured out who I was, then what is it I wanted to do with my time here? And then I look at it and I say, those two things are probably the key components. But then those two were the mental pieces. And then for me, the physical pieces all kind of came into place after that, right? Like diet, sleep, exercise, training, working out. None of those mattered to me until I knew the who and the why I'm doing it, if that makes sense. And then those three, so if I look at it, it was kind of maybe two and then kind of clumped physical all together as one.
That's brilliant, because most people do it the opposite direction. And you and I were talking, both of our parents are of South Asian descent. One of the most common, the question that I was taught to ask in meditation is, who am I and what do I want? And they could be lifelong questions, but basic understanding of who we are and kind of that ownership that comes with that is really special, because then you stop looking for external things to make you happy.
That's the whole game. Like, we live in a world today where, you know, and it's interesting, right? Because I grew up with my mom, still to this day, prays 6 hours a day, every day, nonstop. I cannot get the woman to break. And she'll be like doing her prayers and having a conversation with you at the same time. And I'm asking your mom, are you really praying right now? She goes, oh, yeah, I am. I'm like, no, you're not. You're talking to me, right? But then my dad was a lot more grounded, rooted more Western, the Western world, right? Where he was like, okay, go after your dreams, go make money, go build. And I grew up with this unique world where I had the East and West kind of blend together. And so it was like, okay, go after materialism on one side, and not be materialistic, but you can chase materialism, which was fine. And then I grew up on the other side where it was, my mom was much more on the spiritual side. And what I realized through the two dynamics is I realized that chasing either one was a delusion. I realized that you had to have both materialism and spiritualism to combine in one to really express who you were. And I figured that, okay, so the more I get caught up in chasing the material, I feel more out of balance. And the more I get caught up in chasing the spiritual, I feel out of balance. And when I'm really the most centered is when I'm honoring both physical and spiritual inside that.
That is such a representation of what inspired me to build this podcast. Mm-hmm. I had a very similar upbringing. And what it feels like that you're describing, it's like, it's wholeness.
Yeah.
It's a return to wholeness, understanding that, yes, we have to exist in this physical material world, but there's something much greater kind of operating behind the scenes.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
All right. So on the flip side, I'm sure you've worked with many people who have these habits in their lives that might be uprooting them.
Yeah.
And we live in a world also where optimal wellness can feel really complicated and can feel like a lot of work.
Okay.
To the point where even these healthy practices can cause us to feel uprooted. So do you notice when you drift and there's practices that you have in your life that make you feel uprooted? Let's take a quick break from this episode to talk about something that's made a huge difference in my cellular health lately. It's a product called Fatty 15. If you're like me, always on the hunt for science-backed solutions for optimizing your health and longevity, check this out. Fatty 15 contains a pure bioavailable form of C15, which is a saturated fatty acid that's been coined the longevity nutrient by scientists. C15 was discovered by Dr. Stephanie Van Watson, a veterinary epidemiologist who is studying healthy aging in dolphins. What she found was game-changing. C15 had a remarkable impact, not just on the dolphins, but on human health too. Here's what got me really excited about taking Fatty 15. The clinical research behind it has shown that it strengthens cell membranes, it boosts mitochondrial function, and it activates key pathways that control aging. It outperformed leading longevity compounds in providing over 36 clinically relevant health benefits. And get this, 72% of users in a trial reported better sleep, better mood, better joints, and energy within 16 weeks. I've been taking Fatty 15 religiously as part of my wellness routine, and I have to say, I feel a noticeable difference. My energy is more stable throughout the day, my sleep is deeper and more restful, and I just feel more resilient overall, like my cells have this extra layer of armor against stress and aging. The capsules are small and have a neutral smell and taste, and the refills come in a beautiful, eco-friendly glass jar. I love that Fatty 15 is vegan, pure C15 without any fillers or preservatives. It feels like such a clean, potent way to give my body this essential nutrient it needs to thrive. Fatty 15 is on a mission to optimize your C15 levels and help you live a healthier, longer life. You can get an additional 15% off their 90-day subscription starter kit by going to fatty15.com/Mona and using code Mona, M-O-N-A, at checkout. I really believe that this is something that can benefit all of us in our journey to optimal wellness and longevity. Definitely check it out and see the difference that it can make for you. Again, shop at fatty15.com, that's fatty15.com/Mona, and use code Mona at checkout.
For sure. I think life is there to throw you off balance. If you really think about it, and I think ancient wisdom, going back to it, I think it really goes back to staying centered. But I think life is meant to throw you off balance, and real mastery is when you can stay in centered, and what I call unshakable throughout the game of life. So for me, I have my own rewire processes that I created. I think I created it for the world, but I really think I did it to know me. Right? It's kind of like you. It's like, did I do this for everyone, or I really do this to be myself? I don't know if you're a big Marvel fan. Yeah, so I am too. And there's a scene that's in Doctor Strange. And Doctor Strange and the old wise lady, the guru, and he's like, I'm a doctor. I'm here to help people. And she says to him, you're a doctor to heal yourself.
Exactly.
Yes. I think I cried.
Yeah, it's so true.
It's so true.
Yeah, I talked about that actually this morning, where we come into these paths, but being on the path as a practitioner is what helps us serve mm-hmm. the world, right?
I think so.
Yeah. And, you know, when I found you online, I noticed that you and I share the same language. And one of mm-hmm. the things that you believe in that I understand after researching is this foundation of we are the healer, and mm-hmm. that we have the possibility to actually cultivate a different environment within us to heal. And what I hear from my perspective with the work that I do, it's putting the power back into the client or the patient or the human being to live. And I think with living in this world, we just got stuck in looking for external things to heal us when our bodies are in fact so resilient. And on the flip side, I don't think we were ever taught that our bodies could heal itself. And so we go out into the world, mm-hmm. we see these practitioners who make it look so easy, but we're also dealing with the struggles of what it means to be alive today. And like the statistics around stress that are going up.
It's crazy.
And anxiety and depression and worry and fear that are just going up, that we live in this world. So from my background, from your background, it's understanding that those thoughts are actually cultivating an environment within your body that doesn't sound like the perfect environment for your body to heal.
It isn't, right? If we stop and think about it, right? We go into the ancient side, the yin, the yang, the center, the balance. So like, this is not new concepts, right, that have been there, but how do we get there? And, you know, in my work, what I've been able to do is take science to bring us to that point. I like to call it the science of fulfillment many times, where you can actually use a scientific process, the Western world, I call it, right? The Western side, science, evidence-based, using logic, determination to go, here's A, B, C, D to get me to this place that the West emotionally would call it nirvana or just a blissful state or whatever that may be. Ultimately, what we're doing is regulating the nervous system, right? Ultimately, what you're doing is you're bringing the side of the sympathetic that's overstimulated to balance with the parasympathetic that's understimulated, or vice versa, overstimulated parasympathetic and understand that it's sympathetic. Both sides exist. We only look at it, right, the society and social media and all this only talks about overstimulated sympathetic. Well, we've also got the other side going on in our bodies as well, right? We have clastic and blastic type conditions that are happening. So I think what we're doing and you know, the shows like this and the work that you're doing is helping people get back to that center, helping people get back to the real state of healing. And healing to me is an acronym, right? HEAL to me is an acronym, which stands for helping energy align with love.
I love that. Helping love, energy align with love.
That's it. That's the only healer that is. Love is the only healer that really exists. Everything else is symptomatic.
Yeah. And it's funny with the body, hearing you talk about that balance. I'm always fascinating to understand with, you know, you nailed it, nervous system dysregulation. The focus is on the sympathetic nervous system, but the opposite can be true. And we always jump on one modality to heal or to come back into balance when it's not necessarily about that. You have helped thousands of people tap into their subconscious mind and, you know, the limiting patterns that they have that keep them stuck there. So what is really happening in the brain when we're stuck in that pattern?
It's a great question. So I'm going to take an idea and a concept and I'm going to see if I can debunk it for you. Okay. I don't believe there's a subconscious mind.
Hang up now. This goes against everything that I was taught growing up in the ashram.
Well, that's what we've taught. That's what we've been taught. We've been taught this idea of subconscious. And if we go, like I take the word and say subconscious, meaning that less than conscious. If we know, and I feel like I can say this here, conscious and consciousness is everywhere. So then where is less than conscious? Right? Sub is less than conscious. I think it's much more less than aware, right? Because we are all conscious beings. So what happens to us when we get into these states of less than awareness? And once we bring awareness to a full spectrum, we become conscious of the unconscious.
My brain is just firing right now. So you're really flipping the switch. What that would mean is that we can actually choose to come into the world as a fully conscious state, which is what most of us spend lifetimes trying to achieve.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying.
So how do you help people shift from that construct then of being stuck in that belief?
Well, let's take that and say, okay, well, you know, there was an article done April 16th, Scientific American, they talked about this. I've always had a philosophy and a principle around this because I said, if there's an oversympathetic side, there's got to be a parasympathetic has to be affected. We now know that our nervous system is designed, our brain is designed with neurons, obviously, but there's also anti-neurons. And anti-neurons, therefore we have memories and then we have anti-memories. And we have both sides of this happening in our mind. Hence, like with a lot of the virtual reality stuff we deal with today in technology is based off this premise. And our brains are the things that are constructing this. And so what we're trying to do is say our brain is designed naturally by default to search for the things that support our world and our belief structure. But the belief isn't accurate, right? One day someone can believe that this is right. Now with a new set of evidence, that belief is now wrong. Right? So that means that there's two sides of the belief. If we take this from a philosophical conversation, you now got dualism and structuring into singularity. And so what this work is really in rewiring the brain, what I do is I take this idea and this construct of, okay, if there's one side of a belief and then there's another side of a belief, how do they both must exist. The only thing is that our neurotransmitter of dopamine is going to search for the thing in the reality that's going to make us feel more safe. And that's what limits us.
So I'm about to respond using words and I'm understanding that they're just words. Yeah. So programs, limiting beliefs, limiting decisions, that in of itself is making the decision that they exist.
To some degree, right? And here's the thing I'll tell you is that like in my research, in my work that I've done now, like I don't believe there's a thing as a limiting belief. Right. Because is it limiting or is it there? Is the belief there designed to keep you alive and surviving? Right. So is it limiting you or is it actually keeping you safe? Because the brain is always functioning to do everything in its power to keep you safe. Then what we have to do is realize that, oh, if the brain is trying to keep us safe, this thing that we call limiting belief must not be the thing that we should judge and say is bad. It must be the thing that we need to become aware of and become grateful for before we try and eliminate it. Because when we become grateful for that, then do we transcend it?
That's so interesting. You're making me think of a client this week who, you know, she resisted any type of, you know, call it removing a food that we just knew wasn't good for her.
Sure.
She saw and felt that as hardcore restriction.
Yeah.
And this is a woman who her whole, all she wants is freedom. She wants to feel freedom, wake up for, with freedom. Anything that is taking away her freedom feels like sacrifice and suffering. But that's just a belief again, right?
It's correct. Just,
right. It's, yeah, it's fascinating because I think that in her mind, maybe this experience of wanting suffering is just a way, you know, for her to, I'm going to give a lot of detail. So for her to keep a lot of junk food, for example, in the house, she saw that almost as a form of survival. So if that makes her feel freedom, then that means that she feels safe.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, that's a big expansion. So let's break this back just a little bit more for people. So
I went too deep too quickly. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, because I'm just thinking for listeners, you know, these are a lot of buzzwords that are floating around social media. Yeah. And I think people, especially the word trauma, is like floating around like, oh, we all have our trauma, which yes, but understanding where it comes from. So can you maybe give a background on the reason why we might have these beliefs that cause us to act in a certain way from the time that we are born to, you know, where you are today, what's happening in the brain?
Yeah. So what happens is this, right? From the moment we're born, we're instantaneously chasing dopamine. From the moment we need food, someone gives us food. Now this person's now supporting us. So in our life, we'll support the idea that people will, whoever supports us is good. They are safe. They give us dopamine. So that dopamine rush kicks in. And so this word trauma, I don't believe in, because trauma people perceive as just this negative thing, right? But now if I extrapolate this just for a second, and I won't go too deep into it, but the higher we chase dopamine, the more we have to crash from dopamine. And these catecholamines that go up in dopamine and have to come down from cholamine are norepinephrine and epinephrine. And so what goes up has to go down. And so people don't realize that they don't want the downside. Everyone's chasing the idea of happiness, but happiness is what breeds the sadness. And so we have a society, look, mental health is a crisis today, and I'll take it head on. 40 years ago, when we started thinking everyone should be positive, is when we created this psychosis. Positive thinking breeds psychosis, right? Because this is all neurotransmitters. The idea of happiness, if you give me water and I'm dehydrated, I'm going to say, oh my God, you're the best, Mona. I can't believe it. But if you gave me whiskey and I'm a drunk, then you're going to sit and say, you're the worst. You see my point? And so what happens in our brain is what we think is trauma is nothing more than pain in our psyche. But the real trauma is something I've coined in a term called positive trauma. The person that hits the valedictorian, their life struggles after that. The athlete that scores a touchdown, that stumbles, can't do anything more. The person that gets everything they want in their life, they succeed, they make all this money, the exiting of a company, and on the back end, they become depressed. The elation leads to the depression. And so I call them both a form of trauma. I call them a root experience. Both of them are going to create this psychosis of emotion. If that makes sense.
I want to take a quick break from today's episode to tell you the truth. Healing is so much more than just food and supplements. It's about community, connection, and accountability. My name is Mona Sharma, celebrity nutritionist, and that's why I built The Rooted Community, a space where we can learn, grow, and support each other on this wellness journey. Inside, you'll get access to exclusive content, Q&As, deep dive discussions, and real connections with like-minded people. If you're tired of going at it all alone and want a space where wellness finally makes sense, join today at monasharma.com. Yeah, and what a beautiful reframe, you know, to go back to the conditioning that happened on always be happy, you have to be happy, to understand that that was actually resilience within our body in order for us to feel the pain and the sadness is only instigation to try to move out of it and away from it. And that it's not something that we have to get stuck on. But maybe because of that from society and that belief system, do you think that that's what's caused people over the years to maybe become addicted to their problems or addicted to suffering?
I think so. Look, you know, there's a lot of people that sit and say like, oh, here's my problem. And then as long as people support it and give value to it and say, oh yeah, here's your victim story now becomes your cause. Right. And that victim story, unfortunately, gives you more support and gives you more belief that you are being validated, that you will hold on to that victim story. It doesn't empower you. It doesn't empower you as an individual. It gives you support, and that support can be resentment. That support could be frustration, but you'll hold on to it as long as you're getting more support on the outside. And unfortunately, we have more, I think, right? This is my opinion, with more people in that victim consciousness than we do empowered consciousness.
So for them specifically, what's happening neurologically and how can they understand that they can actually break free?
Yeah. And it's all a relation to the sympathetic nervous system. Anything that's going to support us, we think is good. That's going to release dopamine, we're going to say is great. Anything that's going to challenge us, we're going to say is bad. And we're going to say is sympathetic, but epinephrine and norepinephrine. And those are going to become the stress neurotransmitters. And we say, oh, this supports, this is good. That's the neurotransmitter happening. Anything that challenges, we say is bad. So if we go through experiences of pain, we want to avoid that pain, right? So our psyche is designed to seek pleasure, avoid pain. But when we can see pleasure and pain simultaneously, do we actually create the state of healing within our body, but also our psychology? And then that's when we start to balance the body out. That's when we create this homeostatic psychology.
Right. That's so interesting because, you know, if we look at two people who live very stressful lives,
sure.
There's one person who can do a complete reframe and understand the gifts behind the stress mm-hmm. versus the other person who, God, every day I'm so stressed. That's all they feel is stress. They're just overcome with the emotion of stress. It takes over. Becomes part of their DNA almost.
Yeah.
How is that something that we talked a bit about this before the show? Is this genetic? Is this hardwired from birth? Is this because something bad happened to cause you to feel stress that your nervous system just held onto it and remembered it? What's causing that?
There is a predisposition. So, you know, as we were saying, like I've created the first brain DNA test, right? And what we decipher in this, in my work, what I've realized is there's five primary emotions that we live in our life. And these five primary emotions are infatuation, pride, guilt, shame, and resentment. Everything becomes a subset of these. And I've traced back the neurotransmitters that control that. And then now what I've done is I've created the test that actually tests the genes of those neurotransmitters. So for example, let's use someone who has MAOA. MAOA is known as the worrier or the warrior gene, right? And if you have a gene SNP that says you're going to have a low amount of MAOA, that means a high amount of dopamine, you will naturally be more resilient. And it's called a warrior for a reason. They'll run through walls, not have an issue. But the person that has a high MAOA will have a lower amount of dopamine in the system, and they'll constantly be the worry wart. They won't have the energy. They won't feel motivated. They will feel like, hey, look, you know what? I don't know. And they'll be nervous and scared. And they won't be able to sleep. They'll be freaked out because they're always in a freaked out state. Now, the environment that you put yourself in will also play. But here's the funny thing. My dad's a great example of this. Okay. My dad is a perfect example of this. I used to remember saying to my kid, as a kid, dad, like we'd be late 5 minutes and he'd get flipped out and he'd freak out and get pissed off. And I'd say, Dad, did anyone die? No. He's like, no, but we have to be on time. I'm like, do we really? And then I thought, and then I went through school. And then I'm like, Dad, when are you going to stop stressing? When you're done with school, right? I said, okay, sure. And I go get married. My dad still hasn't yet. And he's still doing the same thing because he doesn't realize that he's hardwired that way by his genes, which is why he doesn't sleep well at night, which is why he's anxious. He will literally be at my house and we will feel the anxiety in the house, the mirror neurons of that anxiety in the house. Like, oh my God, why am I so anxious? I will wake up at 4 a.m. feeling these heart palpitations as we're talking about, right? And then he leaves and all of a sudden it's calm. Now, this is my father. I'm not judging him, right? I say that to him. He's like, because I don't know what you're talking about. This is just who I am. That is who they are. But what that does is it deregulates their nervous system. So what if we could go back? And this is what this gene test is about. What if we can go back and get to the gene SNP that's causing this, rebalance that with rewiring their brain, the right nutrition, the right diet, the right exercise, the right sleep. And this is one of the things I really admire about the work you do is you bring such a, you know, there's a lot of people online who are, you know, you got to lift this many weights and that. And you are so graceful in movements, not just fitness, because not everybody needs high amounts of high intensity training. many people, based on their genes, could actually need much more slower and lower movements to actually get them to get the weight loss, to get them to function. Their adrenals need to calm down. But we're not discussing that. We're discussing everyone should be generic.
Yeah. And to that point, I think that's what gets me most excited about the people that I work with is uncovering kind of all of the things that cause them to be who they are, how they show up, how they think. And my mom sounds like your dad. She's the anxiety blueprint. She's the worry. But what I'm understanding is that these behaviors then can also be in big part a part of your epigenetics and the things that you can do to cultivate change. But I wonder if for their generation, maybe that's not even part of their belief of what can happen. Oh, I've lived my whole life this way. This is who I am. How can I change?
I don't know. Here's the interesting thing about it is that, like, for example, someone like my dad, right? Someone, he's super motivated in what he wants to do, what he wants to value. But if I give him some L-tyrosine and up his dopamine, I'm going to bring his dopamine up regardless. So if I bring his dopamine up, his testosterone is naturally going to go up. If his testosterone is going to go up, everything else is going to change, right? If we get to the root cause, which is what we're talking about here, then can I change physiology? And can we change someone's physiology by putting the right amino acids and nutrition and the raw materials that someone needs to be balanced rather than this dysregulation that everyone's under?
I love hearing you say that word because I feel like your work right now, especially at this point in history, is so important.
Thank you.
Would you say that, you know, would you agree that it's a result of the time and modernization and the things that we're exposed to? You said dopamine a few times. We are, you know, addicted to dopamine hits. Mm-hmm. Our children are becoming even more addicted. Is it a result of the time? Is this something that our ancestors really had to think about? Were they aware of their limiting beliefs, or was there a little bit more of a sense of ease?
I don't know that they knew about it. I don't think so. Like, right, like you're saying, like, would our parents know the difference? I don't think so. I don't think most people will know the difference. Like you say, dopamine, people don't realize it. Everyone sits at night, they scroll through their phone. Why am I not sleeping at night? Because you're not scrolling till 2 a.m. And it's the blue light. We talk about the blue light, the phones, all that, but it's really the neurotransmitter of dopamine waking you up, keeping you going, right? And as Andrew Huberman has said, right, like your dopamine receptors are burned out because of these things. And it's a fact. These are all facts, but I don't think people realize it. I don't know if it's, maybe it's timing. I don't know. I remember, you know, 30, 40 years ago, dating myself a little bit. But, you know, what I loved, and which is what I love about the work you do, I remember watching Deepak Chopra, who's been like just an icon. Like, I've met him a few times just in like a book signing. I remember the first time I met him, I was so nervous. I ran. I was like, I don't want to be a... I'm like, but he's been like an icon. And he was like this figurehead to me that just said that I wanted to do something similar. I wanted to help people heal mind and body. And so I think my journey has just been understanding the science, but also looking at it from a holistic perspective and kind of tying everything together one to another. So I don't know if it's a function of the time. Maybe it is. Maybe consciousness wanted this creativity. I don't know. Maybe it could be. I don't know.
I'm going to say it is. Yeah.
All right. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. I talk about Quantum Healing, a book by Deepak Chopra.
Sure, of course.
When that was first launched, people thought he was a quack. And then now there's the science backing it up. But it is this consciousness. It is the power of your thoughts to really manipulate how you feel. And for the amount of cases that are out there that don't get the media and attention that they deserve from somebody going through a process like yours, when they can actually change their belief system and how that impacts their internal world so that cancer cells can no longer grow, like, that has to be front page news.
But I don't think it will be.
I don't think it will be for a little while.
I don't think it will be. It should be, but I don't think it will be.
We have to keep talking about it.
I think so. I think there's just too much money on the other side.
So you mentioned those primary emotions.
Yeah.
And in my world, books by David Hawkins that assess, you know, this concept of frequency. I used to use the word vibration with my clients. They looked at me like I was crazy. Now they're starting to understand energy, which you and I have talked about. But a few of those emotions are kind of these low vibrational states. And if you're going out into the world in this low vibration, you just think about the things that you're going to attract, the type of choices that you're going to make for yourself, whether it's for food or what you're going to do or who you're going to see, the conversations that you'll have. Do you talk about frequency?
All the time.
Yeah.
Like you read that. Like I don't know if you saw the smile on my face. I was like, Yes, power versus force. Here we go. Absolutely. And as he talks about, right, the chart that he draws, he depicts all the frequencies, I think is one of the most brilliant things in his work I've ever seen. But yeah, I think if I remember correctly, guilt is like a 20 hertz. Fear is like 100 hertz. And anger, if I remember correctly, is like 150 hertz. Yeah, and shame is low. Shame is lowest. That's right. That's 0 to 20. That's right. And guilt is not. So yeah, absolutely. There's no question. So that's why I use these terms, because what I've identified in the work that we're doing is that, and he calls enlightenment what I call love, that state. What I found is that when your nervous system is centered and you are completely in a state of equanimity and equilibrium between the parasympathetic and sympathetic is when you experience love. And that is the state of healing, which is the highest state of oxygenation, which is inspiration versus expiration. In our body, we know if you want to live a healthy life, you need oxygen in the system. That's why the work that you do with breath and yoga and movement, because it's about oxygenating these areas that are stuck, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you're the expert in that world, not me. But the work that I'm doing is exactly the same thing, but I'm not putting movement to it. I do in my seminars, I do put movement into that piece. But what I'm doing is I'm taking moments and events that are happening, rebalancing them that so I can get a cell that's deoxygenated to reoxygenate itself and come back to life.
So good.
And literally that's what I'm doing. That's why I have cases, hundreds of cases of irritable bowel disease, Crohn's disease, lupus, migraines, you know, things that are uncurable that they say is not possible. It is curable. We did a study and we did these EEGs on people's brains. And I did the first EEG. And honestly, the first time I did it, I was like, I hope this works. And the guy, we did, it had a brain age to it. They did an EEG and had a brain age to it. And I looked at the brain age and the brain age was 42 years old, 35-year-old Navy SEAL. Like you're thinking, how is this guy? But his brain age was 42 years old. 40 minutes later, I rewired him. His brain went down to 24 years old.
Come on.
Dead serious.
You said 24 hours?
40? No. 40 minutes.
40 minutes.
40 minutes.
Okay.
40 minutes. I talked to the neuropathologist of the company, and he said, that's impossible. I said, no, it's possible. I do it every day. I know I do this every day.
Yeah.
And he said, no, you're supposed to be able to change brain age 2 to 3 years every 6 months. I said, can I prove it to you? And he says, yeah. So we had a seminar. I did one of my internal seminars that we do. And in the seminar, I had 130 people lined up. And we did EEGs on them, on the pre. And then I went through, we did the whole seminars. I rewired the entire room. I did my processes and I did the entire day. We rewired them. The next morning, I rewired them because I didn't want to take the fatigue factor, right? The average brain age in that room went down 18 years. The average. That means that there was one lady, I could tell you, she was 62 years old and she was already fit. She did all the biohacking stuff, cold plunging, all this stuff. So her brain age was at 57 already. She was already doing great. She was holding on to so much resentment in her life from a business deal that went bad. And she could not make more money. She could not come back in the business. She could not grow. And I have a saying that whatever you resent, you resist, right? And so we rewired the resentment in that day. She came back the next morning. This lady's 64 years old. Her brain age said 22.
Incredible. And I know this is possible. Mm-hmm. I really do. There's a concept that I was taught a long time ago. It's called changing your state. And I don't think it is changing your state. I think it's remembering who you are.
Ooh,
it's remembering how you came into this world. Yeah. So this concept of love, like when you can fully live in love and peace. And I know for both of us, well, for myself anyways, your mom praying every day. My dad and at the ashram, we pray, we have all these modalities that we have to practice every day to become one with God instead of recognizing that we already are. We have the capacity to be in that state.
Here we go. Let's
here
go.
Here we go.
And we are that.
I want to merge that idea with here you and I are in this Western medical world where people want data and science, which I love. We need that. But what you did in that 45 minutes was you completely changed the trajectory of that person, how they were going to age, how their body can heal, how they're going to make decisions for themselves moving forward 100%. In 45 minutes. No hardcore protocol. There wasn't a crazy diet that went with it. They weren't on the treadmill for 45 minutes a day.
Nope.
That was it. Yeah. And this is where I've always wanted, maybe we need to talk about this. I would love to take like two study groups, the group that's eating the Mediterranean diet and meditating for 30 minutes a day and doing all the right things versus people who aren't necessarily doing that, but tapping into the quality of the mind and the ability that that is able to make your body change, and to see and to showcase that they're both possible. I want to take a quick break from today's episode to ask if you know that stress doesn't just feel different for everyone. It affects your body in unique ways based on your hormones, your genetics, and your nervous system. Some people burn out quickly, while others store stress as inflammation, weight gain, or anxiety. My name is Mona Sharma, celebrity nutritionist, and that's why I created the Stress Personality Quiz, a quick, science-backed tool to help you understand your stress type and learn how to manage it effectively. Ready to take control of your stress? Find your stress type now at monasharma.com/quiz.
I think so. I the research is showing it, right? And like you said something like that, you are that, right? Like my favorite quote of all time is Om Tat Sat.
Mm, yes.
You are that.
I was going to get that tattooed when I was younger. Yeah.
I have an Om on my shoulder.
I have an Om on my neck.
Get out.
Come on.
I have an Om on my shoulder. Well, actually, the Om on my shoulder has a triangle around it because to me, the term Delta was so important. Right, my first clinic was named Delta, and so when I did that tattoo on my 30th birthday, my mom yelled at me. She's like, "Alok, what are you doing?" Right, so I got this tattoo. But the whole world was Om is, and you, I'm sure your audience knows this, right? It's the three sounds that are universal in the world: Om, El, U, and M. And I said, "Okay, so this tattoo to me represents change the world through the power of the universal God." Right. And that's what I dedicated my life to that. And that's what I follow. That's the cause. Who is Alok? That's who he is, right? And so as you're saying this in the merger of science and health, and I think it's all possible when you start to realize that you want to make it possible. And so many people are afraid of making it possible. And that's kind of the work. Like for me, I'll tell you, like I wasn't this health freak all the time. I wasn't. I was 50 pounds overweight. I smoked cigarettes. I drank like a fish. I was a jerk. Like I had temper. I still sometimes blow up. I'm human, right? Like that. And that's the thing I think people try and sit and say, you have to disown every part of yourself and be a one-sided being. No, I have to be human, which means I have to embrace all parts of being. And we try to be something that we're not. And I think that's what creates so much dysregulation in the nervous system, psychologically, physiologically. So the more I started to embrace who I was, the more I started to see who I was. And the more I started to see that, the healthier I chose to become. So now I don't have to choose to eat healthy. I don't have to. You could put whatever in front of me. And if, you know, and not to say that I won't have a chip and salsa once in a blue moon, right?
I eat the chips. I eat the salsa.
I mean, I do once in a while, but I will look at it and be like, do I want it? And I'll make that decision. Is this serving my what I want now or not? I think we're so unconscious half the time that we don't look at that.
What I'm feeling you describing these stories in these case studies is the same kind of inspiration. So for me, the symbol of Om, when you have an experience of what it feels like to feel peace and health and happiness and love, you know it exists, you know it's real, and you know you can get back there. And so for me, it's this just this representation of a vibration that I know I can always go back to within myself. So I love that you brought that up, because I think that for listeners, it's really understanding that these are things that you can actually break up with and change. So this is a good segue. Like, let's really dive into the good stuff. So for people who are so, you know, goal-driven, goal-motivated, and it's really become them, how do they shift from being so focused on the outcome to becoming the version of themselves to get to the outcome?
Be, do, that, right? Be, do, have. That's what it is, right? It's really interesting. So let me take this, maybe this question from a law of attraction scientific standpoint, okay? So how do you become that? The neurotransmitter that is the neurotransmitter of self-love is oxytocin. Oxytocin is the midline, whereas dopamine is the goal, and the resentment and shame is the flip side. So if you think about it, oxytocin is the center balance. So when you don't chase something that's outside of yourself, you don't need to resent anything outside of yourself. You are the most connected to who you are in the present so that you can actually love who you are. And when you love who you are, then that's where things come to you. That's where you create the universe that you want to. That's where you create the life that you want to. That's that state of peace that you're talking about, where it's like, oh, right? Like if someone said, like my brain says, okay, I was in the personal development world for so many years and everyone said this stuff and I didn't get it, right? And I would, they'd say, change your beliefs, change your life. Great. I'd be back. I was backstage Mona and I'd say, how do you do that? How do you go and do that? Like, and I'm not a, you know, I did all this to save my own life, as we were saying earlier, right? I was like, I got to figure this out because I'm not making any money. I'm just coming off of a brutal divorce. I was doing intermittent fasting before it was a thing. Like, I mean, I had a lemon to eat for 4 days. Not because I was being healthy. I had no money. I was broke. I lost it all through my divorce. And I would ask all these gurus in the world and say, well, how do you change? I need to change my life. I need to make money. And they'd say, well, you change your beliefs. Great. Thanks. Rocket science. Right? And then they would sit and say to me, well, I said, well, how do I know what my beliefs are? And they'd say, well, you know, we don't really know exactly what that is. And I'd say, okay, well, if you don't know what it actually is, how do I know what it looks like? And they say, well, you look at your environment and that's your beliefs. And you know, for me, Mona, like the BS meter went off. Because here I am, I'm a doctor. I've got patients that come in to see me and they'll have back pain. That'll be the symptom. But the cause of it could be a herniated disc, spondylolisthesis, spondylolysis, cancer, pedicle fracture. Could be a multitude of different things. And that's when I realized that the belief was the symptom, not the cause. And so I ended up going home that night, driving home. And I kid you not, I was like an Indian Einstein. Like I pulled out all my textbooks and I said, I have to get to the core of the anatomy of this belief. And it was, honestly, it wasn't for anybody else. It wasn't to save the world. It wasn't, I was like, I got to figure this out for me because no one else is coming to save me. And so I figured out that the HPA access, I figured out the whole process behind it. And I created this system and I created a belief in my brain once I figured it out that I'd create this belief that you could have love or money, but not both. So what am I going to do? Our brain is going to chase love because it feels good. And it's going to avoid money because it feels bad. So as an entrepreneur, here I am fighting, resisting, working harder, trying to do things when it was actually creating the exact opposite in my life. So I began the rewiring process. I said, let me see how I balance this thing out. I was already doing it with patients, but I was like, now I have to become my own patient.
What an incredible story.
That's how it all started. And so for an entrepreneur, I think that's where you have to realize is number one, what are the actual beliefs? Is where I'm going with that. What are the actual beliefs? And then rebalance those.
It's also a very brave journey because most people don't want to admit that. There's a term called toxic positivity. Mm-hmm. We live in this world. I am great. I am healthy. I am fit. I am motivated. And inside that individual, it might just feel like there's suffering or turmoil.
Absolutely.
Do you have a process of investigation that you take with your patients when they come in to really decipher if they do have deep limiting beliefs that they might not be conscious of?
Sure, yeah. I mean, everyone has a construct in their mind. You have to, right? We have these rules, these constructs in our brain that decipher where we are. And so I've created, like, the first thing I do is I do a belief inventory. What are your actual beliefs? How do I know what I'm working with if I don't know what they actually are? And if we don't do a belief inventory, all I'm doing is speculating on everything I'm doing. So that's like, you know, I'm in LA right now. I'm going to fly to wherever I'm going next. But I need to know I'm starting in LA. If not, I'm randomly changing something that I think I want to be better rather than really knowing what I'm doing. So I do a belief inventory on everybody because a belief inventory is the foundation to know where you are to begin. Then make the changes.
I work with a lot of people who they think that getting healthy is hard. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot to commit to. It often feels very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that feeling of hard, it bleeds out into other parts of their lives. Every day kind of feels like an uphill battle. And I really enjoy this analogy of thinking, like, if you think that hard is your lens of life, a simple concept of just like taking off the glasses of hard and what would it feel like for a moment to not have that anymore. And for people who can just like imagine for a second, oh, well, that would feel amazing. Life would feel really, really great. Just the acknowledgement of that is the recognition that they have a belief that's taking them out of feeling happiness.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Instead of, I think for, you know, especially when you get to your 40s, 50s, and beyond, like your dad, the person who's lived a certain way for so long, it's all they know, to finally just see a different perspective, like, oh, maybe things could be a little bit different, and understanding that. So I really like that, a belief inventory. I think that that's something that we should all do.
I think, I think that's great. And I actually like, tell me more about what you're doing there, because I'm curious. Like, so what do? Like, you tell them that if you take that lens off, and if it was easy, how would that be? Is that kind of what you're asking them?
That's literally it. So we'll take a specific scenario that they're living through, how they're feeling about that situation, why they feel that way, where it comes from, and then what would happen if you took the lens off. Like literally like it was a glass frame of a yellow lens. They would see the world in yellow.
Got it.
Versus taking that lens off.
And I mean, it makes complete sense for what
And it's not to say that behavior will change immediately. Maybe now as I go through your process, we can do it a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But through there, we just go through visualization using some breath work. And what would it feel like to not have that lens throughout the day? Yeah. What would it feel like if you got to the gym and it wouldn't feel strenuous? You could actually feel happiness. What would it feel like to, you know, think about food and have it feel really easy and flow? Like you were nourishing yourself
embracing
instead of dieting.
Embodiment.
Embracing embodiment.
Got it. Completely makes sense. Yes.
Yeah. So in studying, you know, I just realized that I think 70, 80% of the population is maybe stuck in fear motivation, right? Is this part of the brain that scarcity bias? Is this something that people...
I think it's more than that.
Really?
I don't know that. I don't know an exact figure, but my guess would be it'd have to be more than that.
So few people are actually goal motivated, right? It's often the fear of getting sick or something bad happening or not having enough money, right? That keeps them stuck where they are?
I think here's something that's really interesting. If the goal, like, so in our brain, we have the prefrontal cortex, right? It's a pretty common term, and it's actually designed in the telencephalon. And the telencephalon is about the telos, which is about the direction you're moving in your life and the end result. So if we know where we want to go, then we structure our life not by a destination of a goal, but by a journey of the experience, because the end experience is that experience. You see what I'm saying? So when we do, the second phase we do is like the values and identity process. And values is like this generic term that people use, like, you know, honesty, loyalty, friendship. Those aren't values. Those are social idealisms. Real values are the things that your life currently displays, exhibits, that you do every single day. Right? I go to the gym every single day. Even if I'm doing recovery day, I go to the gym to do my stretches, to do my recovery workout, like whatever it is, it's every day. It's not, but so if I said, oh, I don't exercise, or excuse me, I'm not valuing health, that's not true. I do. I live my life based on that. But if I said, I hear this with entrepreneurs and business owners all the time, oh yeah, I really want to build a business. I want to build an entrepreneurship. How many hours are you working? I'm not. What are you doing with your time? Well, I'm at home with the family. I'm cooking dinner. And I get it, because mom guilt is a real thing. It's a complete thing. And I've helped hundreds, if not thousands, of women rewire that thing. It's a real biological process. But yes, you can rewire that. My point is that that person values family, not business. So they're judging themselves, creating guilt and shame, thinking that this is what they think they're supposed to do, but in essence, creating guilt and shame by not knowing their own values and true identity by the structure of their life.
Which is keeping them stuck where they are.
Which is keeping them stuck. It's exactly right.
And that's exactly, I guess, the definition of your outer world being a reflection of your inner world, mm-hmm. right? And so can people change their inner values then?
100%. Here's the cool thing about this. Like, that's why I wrote the book, Wired for Wealth. Wealth was not about money. Wealth is about being whole. The term wealth means to be whole. Right. And so you get like this thing is the coolest thing on the planet, because you can wire this to build and create whatever you want to. You can wire your brain to create whatever experience you want to. And that's not this woo-woo manifestation thing. It's a literal science that I can build my brain to do what it is I want it to do to give me the result I want to build and create in my life.
Ah, so good. Meanwhile, though, we're stuck on this hamster wheel of chasing things mm-hmm. and doing things in a certain way because we don't even have the belief that that is a superpower of ours.
I don't think people, maybe, I don't know. I think people are stuck on the hamster wheel. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about that, you know, thinking about a lot of the, you know, CEO, A-type people that I work with who they're prone to energy burnout.
Yeah, for sure.
I had burnout completely. They probably don't believe in that cycle of burnout that they can rewire their brain, or it's always about going deep in what they're doing. Oh, you know, as soon as I finish this, then I'll think about how to heal. As soon as I get this done, as soon as I make this much money, as soon as I lose this much weight, then I'll try to go down another path, instead of realizing that it's the power of their brain and their beliefs that could actually regain their energy.
Completely. Right. And here's the, you know, in this world, like every time you have a judgment, you are pinging this part of the brain called the habenula. And the habenula is literally the opposite of the prefrontal cortex. And it's literally every time you think, oh man, I should build a business, I should go after this goal, but I'm not, I'm doing something else, I'm a failure. It just, then what you do is you're actually building this habenula to be bigger. And it becomes stronger and more reinforced. In the same capacity, the reason I say that is because in our society, these entrepreneurs, these people that we're going after, that habenula has been hit so long, it's just so much bigger that we internally, and here it is, here's the money, internally we feel guilty, shameful, like a failure for all the things that we think we're supposed to do to make everyone else happy and never figure out what to do for ourselves.
It's fascinating because I have a feeling that a question I ask my clients often is, what would I hear if I was in your head?
You know, that's a good question.
The time you woke up in the morning until you went to bed. And it's this that I'm speaking to. How many times would I hear you be in judgment of yourself and your actions and who you are? Which is a really sad place to be. And to your point about that trigger reaction over and over and over, it's like it becomes us.
Does. I think it does, right? Like it does become you. It becomes a language in your head. It becomes a language that you live by. And then now to go back to power versus force, then now that's the frequency that you put into the world. That's the energy now that you're putting out into the world. People sit and say that your thought energy is what you create. No, that's not the research I've seen, right? It's not your thought energy. Thinking is the language that you tell the body. Feeling is the language you tell the universe. And so if you have to think a certain way to get your body to feel a certain way, but then that feeling has to go into the world. And then you create it. If you always think, man, I got to go hit this next goal. If not, I'm a failure. I got to hit this next goal. Or if I'm a failure, then what you're always going to say internally is that I feel like a failure. A great practice, if this could help your audience, is take someone you love very, very closely. We do this in my company, is we do our morning meeting. And every day in our morning meeting, everyone has to go around the room. Every single person. There's no exceptions to this rule. Like if you're in Dr. T's world, this is the rule. You don't have to be, but this is the rule, right? But everyone has to say two things they're grateful for. Because we know that if you're grateful, you're going to release oxytocin. You're going to balance these chaotic thoughts. You're going to release oxytocin. You're going to become more centered and grounded in your state. If we can, and this is what I've been trying to do for years, is to get entrepreneurs to get more oxytocin in their body, they're going to become more centered and not have this chaos of family business. And so we do this in my company. And what we have found is tremendous amount of love, loyalty, empathy, but teamwork, productivity, and growth that happens because of it.
So beautiful. Even the act of doing that is practice. Practice mm-hmm. is retraining. And I would love to see an image of the brain in full gratitude. Like, I'm sure it's just like...
We gotta call Dr. Raymond.
Yeah, exactly. Let's
maybe
do this.
He's got let's something. Compare. Like, let's go do that because he could pull that off.
Yeah, well, physiologically too. You know, I always think about my heart and the brain. If the brain is firing on gratitude, that communication, the signals that get sent to the heart, that puts the mm-hmm. heart at ease, that sends communication and signal to the gut microbiome, that puts all the nerve endings in our gut microbiome at ease. And then all of a sudden, we're working in flow and synergy.
That's right. The whole system.
So for listeners then, do you have, for the people you work with who do experience burnout, any simple practices? The gratitude seems like a really great piece.
Yeah, there's a couple things I would tell you to do, right? So some of them will seem like the antithesis of what you've been taught. So I would say to govern your burnout, don't start your day with this toxic positivity. Don't start these affirmations. Don't do these incantations. Don't do that. Start your day by asking yourself, what are the biggest challenges I'm going to have today? And then ask yourself, what are five benefits of each one of these challenges?
Oh, wow. What is it teaching me?
It's governing whatever you're going to face. So you drop the anxiety immediately. And now this thing that you think is a negative thing now is much more a governed thing that you just have to walk through and take care of versus all this emotional chaos around it. And then at the end of the day, find all the things that went great and find the drawbacks to those. And all the things that went well, or excuse me, all the things that went horribly and the benefits of those. Five of each. Take the big two or three. What you will find is your HRV is going to increase. Your heart rate is going to decline. Your blood pressure declines. Your nervous system becomes more regulated. Your REM sleep goes up every single time because of this. REM sleep is the mind. Deep sleep is the body. So when you do this, you are literally governing your entire nervous system, emotional system, and your heart feels that impact. So now all of a sudden, it's a simple hack, but now you're sleeping better, managing your day better, making better decisions, and not getting in the chaos by the world around you. My friend, Chris Gethin, a trainer, he has a beautiful saying that he's taught me, and it's really been something really good for my life as well. It's that you control your environment. Don't let your environment control you. And the more you control this environment, the more you control that environment. That's the other piece of it.
That is beautiful. Yeah, I think it's a pretty automatic reaction for people to wake up in the morning. Stress. Yeah. What do I need to do today? It's going to be so busy. It's going to be so stressful. But that's fascinating. If we can live through the process first thing in the morning, come into our bodies and acknowledge like, oh, there's actually some really positive things behind it. It changes our perception of how we move through those activities.
You know what I love about this conversation? I'm the science masculine,
yeah, exactly.
And you're feminizing it in the energy and the emotion. I love it. Like, I can't do what you're doing.
Like, I need to understand this differently.
You're totally balancing me out. I love it. It's great.
But I love that there's science to validate it. That is the whole point of this podcast. It's wisdom within us. And I think we needed the science to really validate it. And like this concept of trauma, like, let's just go back to that for a second. So if trauma is our belief, and we've all had traumas, whether you call it big T trauma, little T trauma, through relationships, how it impacts your self-love or self-worth. When you said people can't heal trauma, they don't need to heal trauma, you need to rewire it. So how on earth can we rewire something that feels so intense and deep for us?
Yeah, there's a process, right? And I would sit and say that you don't want to, rewiring is the process. What you want to do is love that trauma. And really love it. Like this morning, literally one of my clients, super successful entrepreneur, female entrepreneur. She's been having these memories and these moments in her life where she recalls that she was molested as a child. Pretty graphic stuff, very challenging for sure. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong before everyone comes and attacks me. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, good or bad. I have no judgment pull in the game. All I do know is that it happened. And what we have to do is regulate your nervous system around it, period. If not, the body doesn't heal, right? And so it took me 45 minutes. I rewired something that happened 50 years ago in her life. And she was grateful for the experience and grateful for what it had taught her, what it had become of her. And we rebalanced the brain. And she's like, my entire body feels light. I said, freedom. I said, you've been holding on to this moment, this experience in your physiology, right? Every cell in our body, I'm sure in this podcast you've talked about this, every cell in our body is holding on to every memory. And so all of that is part of the illness factor. And if we are to heal, then we have to eliminate all of these emotional, quote unquote, traumas that we hold on to, both positive and negative, so that we can actually be free and allow the nervous system to regulate the way it's designed to.
This is such a good segue. Okay, you're not, putting people into hypnosis.
No.
You're not using crazy machinery and expensive devices.
No.
This is you with your patients one-on-one.
Questions. Yeah. Questions. I don't even practice anymore. I gave away my license because I was like, I don't want to practice. Because I was like, there's too many restrictions in that game. I just want to help people heal and help. And I was like, the more rules I put on myself, the less I can actually help someone heal because it's like, oh, so I call them clients, not even patients anymore because I take away that term. So it doesn't even put that in. Yeah. It's just clients, people I love and people I help. But yeah, it's a series of questions. right? The quality of our life is determined by the quality of the questions we ask. We've heard that's not a new thing. That's a personal development thing, right? But it's true. There's truth to that. If we can ask ourselves better questions, then we can live a better life. What if we can ask questions to help our bodies heal?
And it's such a beautiful journey to witness when someone has experienced the trauma that you described or anything else. It's not that the trauma or the memory just goes away. It's that they can look back and interpret it a different way. It's almost like a process of releasing, right? In Ayurveda, we talk a lot about accumulation.
Okay.
With my mom, she has rheumatoid arthritis, and an Ayurvedic practitioner once told her, it's like, oh, you're storing all of your sadness and your trauma and your emotion within your joints. You have to release it. My mom decided to hold on to everything. She's that type of person. But I think that with this awareness and like making it part of everyday conversation to do the deeper work to get to that point, how much freedom and liberation that you could feel when you go out into the world, then all of a sudden going back to that, you know, hardcore intense overachiever, the feeling of hard dissipates a little bit.
I agree with that 100%.
It becomes a little bit more graceful and easy. And I don't think that life, the purpose of life was never for it to be so hard, right?
You know, I was watching, I don't know, I was scrolling. I was endlessly scrolling when, and that Indian doctor from England.
Chatterjee,
that's right. Yeah. I couldn't think of his name. I really like him. I like what he has to say. And he was talking about this idea when people die, right, on the last day of their deathbed, what are they really regretting? They're regretting the things that they could have been, that they should have let themselves be happy. And I believe, I don't know, I think for all of us, what if we can give ourselves just the permission, not even the freedom, just the permission to be yourself. What would happen to your life if you can give yourself the permission to know your code and who you are to live your life? How do you think the world would be a better place? Like you, like the work you're doing, right? You went through that journey because it wasn't you. It was what somebody wanted for you. And when you figured that out, then it was like, oh, I don't have to be this. And when you don't have to be that, you figure that I can be who I am. And that's when the weight and the cortisol and everything shifts in your story and you can become who you are. And all of a sudden you become the expression of health. And that, like that, I don't think health is a lifestyle. I think health is an expression.
Thank you for that reflection. Something that I do probably on a daily basis is when I catch myself in comparison to other people or what people are doing, what I think I should be doing, I come back to, no, that's their journey. This is my journey. This is how I can do things. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And even that, there's so much freedom. Just the reminder.
I was getting my haircut for this podcast here in Beverly Hills yesterday. You guys charge a lot for a haircut.
Great.
I just wanted to tell you.
Yeah, they do. You went to the wrong place.
I was like, man, how much? It's like, in Chicago, it's not that much. But then you get a Chicago haircut. That's a whole different story. But the guy was telling me, he says, I said, how long have you been doing this? He says, about 3 years. And I said, that's great, brother. I said, that's fantastic. I said, what were you doing before that? He goes, I was on the streets. I'd taken the wrong journey, the wrong path. I'd been on the wrong journey. And I just, you know, this has saved my life, you know, cutting people's hair. And I said, that's fantastic, brother. And he goes, yeah, it was just a wrong journey for a long time. He goes, I found this. I said, brother, and I just turned and I said, can I just stop for a second? I turned and looked at him and I said, you've never been on the wrong journey. You've just been on your journey. And here's a 23-year-old kid who got teary-eyed just for that minute. And he just said, thank you. I said, there was no wrong. It was yours. As soon as you put the label of wrong, you put the judgment in. Eliminate the judgment, therefore you deregulate that nervous system. Just by judgment. When we put judgment on, we put regulating the nervous system and a decentered nervous system. Taking the judgment off, we create the nervous system to be in the flow.
What a beautiful way. You know, I was just about to say that your clients must really love the way that you see them. And what I'm taking from that is like such a good message for all of us for how we look at other people and judge other people, because that's a reflection of us always, right? So if we can pivot and just kind of see that in other people too, I think that that's so important. And it really opens the discussion up for so many things. Like, I love that your work incorporates, you know, your thoughts, the power of your thoughts, and how you can talk about how that bleeds out into the wealth that you've manifested, sure. the relationships that you've manifested, maybe the body that you've manifested. So maybe this is a good segue. Let's pivot a little bit into understanding your mindset when we're rewiring for optimal health.
Mm-hmm.
How does one go about manifesting this if they're stuck in their own beliefs around what their health should be? I think there's also something that happens when you're, you know, in your 40s and 50s.
Yep.
There's this like doom and gloom of what's to come. And to your point, you got to eat your body weight and protein, lift really heavy weights. You've got to be doing this, no screens, like so many things so many rules.
So many rules.
Let's debunk a bit of that in your process.
Where do you want to go with it?
Yeah, so let's talk first about how the power of your thoughts are manifesting your current health today. And maybe for our listeners, I want you to think about maybe your top one, two, or three symptoms and what is impacting you the most. The phrase that I always ask my clients is, if I could wave a magic wand and make three things go away tomorrow morning, what would they be? And then maybe through your lens, understanding on why you have those imbalances to begin with.
So I think when we look at the maybe ask the question in a different way, because maybe I'm like in the context of it.
Yeah. So what would be the first step then in helping someone realize that their symptom is a manifestation of their beliefs?
Got it. I would tell them, again, I go back to the same statement, is that I don't think health is I don't think it's a position. I think it's an experience. So until you don't know yourself and why you do what you do, the brain won't click in. You'll get locked in the amygdala of emotion. So you'll go to the gym, you'll work out, you'll feel better, you'll stop. And you'll go in this yo-yo until it becomes who you are, right? So when I look at it and say, how do we turn health into a facilitation and optimization? To me, it's all mind first. I call it mind first health, mind first healthcare. That's my whole world, is that you want to get healthy, you got to start here first. Every doctor, every practitioner, everyone I've ever talked about is that, cool, they have a hard time getting people to do the exercise, the diet, the routine, the regimens, because they can't lock in to the psychological side. But if we can wire our brain to realize that, oh, being healthy is not work, it's just the healthier I get, the more I get to live my life, what I love to do every day. Oh my God, I want more of that. Right? Longevity, I don't think longevity is be living forever. I think longevity is aging with wisdom. And so when we look at, you know, the first step is know who you are and why you want. And if you love doing what you do every single day, right? Taking power versus force, I like to say people go from a state of need to love to, right? You either need to do things, you live at a low frequency, should do things, have to do things, want to do things, to choose to do things, and choose to do things are the most delusional people because they think they've got it figured out, not realizing there's another stage called love to. And you get up in the morning and you get to sit and say, I love to do this. Like this conversation, I love having this conversation. I could do this every day. This is what I do every day. And I think the more you get into that state of love, the more you're going to want to be healthy so that you can do what it is you actually love.
In NLP, I remember learning a concept that when you're trying to move through any type of change or mm-hmm. moving through a fear, you have to at least find 30% joy factor in that moment. Call it joy or happiness and love in order for you to follow through to maybe attempt to do it again. If we're only living through fear, like if you and I were to show up today in this conversation, but I was in 90% fear,
sure.
the chances of me coming back to this wouldn't be there. But if I can involve a little bit more love and excitement to what I'm doing, call that eating really healthy for your body, going to the gym to work out for yourself. But I think it's another way of really adopting that it has to come back to how you see yourself.
I think so, right? So let me use my kids as an example, maybe, because a lot of this, I think, is so important that it starts in childhood, right? And I would assume that there's a lot of female listeners in this audience. So as motherhood, because a lot of times what we do is we tell our kids what they should do. One of the things that I've found with both my kids, and I've been pretty good at not doing this, is not telling them what they should do. I find what their actual value is, and I connect everything to that. So I remember a time my daughter gave a case example. She was grade 4. She changed from Montessori to public school at the time. And she was having a hard time. She was having a difficult time figuring it out. She goes, I don't know how to learn this way and this and that. And so everyone kind of did the traditional things with school and academics and all this stuff. And I said, kid, let's sit down when you're ready and we'll go through it. And she's okay. Now, my daughter loves music. She was a huge Selena Gomez fan. In fact, I took her to meet her one time. Yeah. And so she was like, oh my God. So what I did is at that moment, I said, okay, she's struggling with math. And I said, where is math in Selena Gomez and music and concerts? She's like, Dad, there is no math there. She goes, she just sings. She's so good. And I said, is she that good or is there math? And she's like, I don't know. And she was learning about angles at that time. I said, if there was a speaker above her head and the angle was 90 degrees, do you think she'd get feedback from that? If there was, what about when she has to go into the audience? How does she talk to me? Does she face an angle? Where does the microphone hold? And I showed her the application of the information in what she valued. And she went from getting D's in math to straight A's. That quickly. 15 minutes. My son, same thing. He was getting 20% in school when he was a kid. And everyone's like, you have to study more. You have to study more. And we think that the kids are going to learn more by telling them to do more. That's not how they learn. It's not it. But we linked together his brain and wired his brain to what's important to him. Now, my son is 16 and a half, 17 years old. He doesn't drink Coke. He doesn't drink. He doesn't eat sugars. Doesn't eat that. And I don't have to tell him. He doesn't have to. He goes to a party. Kids are eating chocolate and this thing. He goes, I don't do that because soccer is his highest value. Everything connects to soccer for him. So when we know who we are, we live our life with the path to know this is what I want to do. Why would I want to be sick or healthy or do these things to take away from doing what it is I want to do more of?
You have to understand that as a child too. So for parents listening then, when you're uncovering your child's value, it's based on the things that they love doing. It's not necessarily about a word that you're looking for. It's based on what they're attracted to.
And believe it or not, it's probably not what you want it to be. It could be as simple as video games, right? It could be, but video games are bad. Are they? Or are they actually very valuable? When a boy or a girl is playing a video game, they're going for a goal. They're trying to get to the next level. They're trying to achieve the next state. These are all goals that they're achieving in what's important to them. One of the coolest games that I watched, and it's still, and there's a movie coming out about it soon, is Minecraft.
Yeah. My daughter and my son love Minecraft.
Love it. Why? Mm-hmm. And I started thinking through it. And my son used to play it all the time. His buddies would play it all the time. I said, why do you guys play this? What are you guys doing with this? And what I realized is in Minecraft, they get to create their own world.
You're building your own world, whatever you want to exist in this world. And I thought for their brain to work that way, that's incredible.
You know why? Because they can't.
Right.
They can't. They're trapped by mommy and daddy's rules.
Nine to five school.
This is it. So they're playing that game to express who they are. And I was like, genius.
It is genius because I think it's the new modern version of what free play is and using your mind in certain ways when we don't necessarily have, we're not able to send our kids out onto the streets to run and get lost and get dirty and stuff like that. So I love that you brought that up. And that's a good segue, too, into this concept of manifestation. Mm. So how is traditional kind of social media manifestation getting things wrong? You touched on it a little bit before, but I want to go back so you expand on it.
All right, here we go. Well, look, I think that this whole concept of what people are calling manifestation is wonderful for marketing. And when we really understand the science of creation, I have a seminar I do every year for the last 8 years I've done. It's called Creation. I take people and I show them exactly the science of how to create the life that they want to. Literally the tools. I give them the exact process to wire their brain, to put it in a frequency of love, to be able to create the world that they want to. Wire your brain, connect it, do all that. Because this brain is the radio transmitter signal that connects between this, we'll call it conscious or unconscious reality and the physical manifestation of reality. And it's this thing that has to tap in and tune in to those things. So if we just sit and say, do a bunch of affirmations and you're going to manifest that life, no, you're not. I see more people that, you know, vision boards that are out there. I call them nightmare boards. Because the truth is, it's comparison. Here's this thing I'm supposed to create and manifest. I get more people on the verge of suicide and depression because of these vision boards. because people are chasing things that aren't them. And it's completely the antithesis of the way that it works. Now, a lot of people will sit and say, all you got to do is visualize and manifest. And I know a lot of these people. And they will go and they'll talk about all this stuff and then they'll go through. And I have nothing against it. But if you're the great creator of your mind and your life, then they'll tell you that they go through, you know, 4-hour therapy sessions every week. I'm like, is there some hypocrisy in this? This doesn't make sense to me. And I have nothing against therapy. Please, that's not what I'm saying. Please listen to the context of what I'm trying to say. I'm saying, if you were the master of the mind and doing that, why do you need to go through that? And I'm not saying if you just want to express and do that, fine. But if you're going there for stress relief, you're missing the point. Manifestation is a one-sided positive delusion. Creation is a two-sided reality of what you want to build into your life. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that people become aware to both sides of something, the more they can manage it, create. I'll say it this way, because I'm being a little squirrely with the words. You can't create what you can't manage.
Right.
And if you can't manage it in your mind, you'll never create it in reality.
So wouldn't you need to guide someone if somebody doesn't know, you know, we talk about this concept of limitless possibilities, mm-hmm. right? If I'm living in scarcity and I don't know what limitless possibilities means, mm-hmm. or if I don't know what wealth and abundance is, how do you guide your clients to feeling it then? If they would they not want to see it somewhere as people do in the vision board?
Well, you have a vision of what you want to experience. I say, you know, it's something you want to experience, right? Being on this podcast is something I wanted to experience, but I had to manage it in my mind to create it. To have this conversation is something I wanted to experience in my life. To do what you're doing today and the people that you're helping, you visualized it, you experienced it in your mind. But here's the thing, like in when we talk about the visualization process, is the experiencing of it, not the expectation of it. And when you experience it, you're living it, you're going through it. It's not all positive. You experience the positives and the negatives of it, the goods, the bads, the highs, the lows, and see, oh, this is what I want to feel. But if we only feel into it through positive, we get rebounded and smacked in the face with the negative.
Yeah. And what I'm also experiencing from what you're saying is, you know, for the amount of people out there, it's no surprise. They get the promotion, they get the house, they get the job, they get the car, they get the wife, whatever it is that they want.
Sure.
And they're still not happy. So what I'm hearing is that you ultimately get people back to the experience of feeling that emotion in the here and the now. And that's how they operate life through.
Presence. You want to create, you got to get your mind present. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And if you get to mind, the way that I do it at least, right? And to get the mind present, you have to get the nervous system present. And how do you get the nervous system present? By rewiring it.
Right. Gosh, this is going by so fast. I would say, you know, you're making me think of my favorite Napoleon Hill quote, what the mind can conceive and believe the mind can achieve.
Sure.
Right? It's such a simple process. So for people then, I want them to obviously go learn so much about you. How do you communicate with your audience? Where do you spend the most time?
Instagram is probably the best. Yeah, Instagram is probably the best place to go.
Can you give us a little teaser on your book that you're writing?
The Unshakable Health?
Yeah.
90 Days to Unshakable Health. I say there's 5 pillars to true health. And I call it an unshakable mind, which is unshakable is customized to you. It's your roadmap, nobody else's. That makes you unshakable when you can be centered and not be steered by the world around you. So the unshakable mind is a component, unshakable body, diet, sleep, exercise. But I like talking about wealth too, because if you don't have money, you're going to lose your mind. You're going to lose your sleep. You're not going to eat right. And you're not going to take care of your body. So all of that kind of plays into the whole world of, as we started the whole conversation, of the physical reality and then the spiritual reality type thing.
Wealth is one of my pillars of health.
I agree.
It's another form of energy and something that we all need.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
I can imagine you work with a lot of people who have to debunk their relationship with wealth and what money means, just like you did.
Right? I think I still do. Yeah. I think I wrote the book initially for me.
Right.
That makes sense. I think I really did. But the cool thing about it is that book is written in a format where it's exercises. That's the way I wrote it, because I wrote it like, here's a tool that people can use and just start working through the exercises for themselves to rewire their own brain.
That was good.
Yeah, so they can do it for themselves. But that's the process I took myself from, you know, intermittent fasting unconsciously to building my career.
And the book is called Wired for Wealth.
Wired for Wealth.
Yeah, beautiful. All right, I'm going to take you through some rapid fire questions.
Shoot, let's go.
You ready? What's one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about changing their lives?
That they can't.
Just a belief.
Just a belief.
What is a daily habit that actually keeps people stuck instead of helping them move forward?
Talking to people about their story.
Reliving it, just like therapy, over and over and over.
Again and again. You remyelinate those neurons and you stay in the story again and again. Stop telling the story. Like I'll tell people all the time is that when they start telling their story, I'm like, stop, 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 stop. I don't want to hear it. Stop. And it sounds rude and intense, but I'm stopping their story because all you're doing is remyelinating that path. So stop the story.
Yeah. How's that working for you still, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're smarter at it than I am. I just tell people to stop. You're like, you ask a better question. I just drool.
What is your favorite ancient healing remedy?
Turmeric.
Turmeric.
Turmeric for everything. I tell you, when you, have that golden tea.
Yeah. Golden latte. Best thing in the world. If you had to pick one thing about modern neuroscience that's exciting you, what would it be?
The fact that we're able to now see what the world, we're able to now see what the brain looks like to help us create a different reality. I don't think that we had that in the beginning part of our, well, we've never had that, but now understanding, uncovering where the brain is going, I think we're going to be able to create so many amazing things out of thought consciousness. I really think if I really take that, I think we're going to be able to preserve consciousness beyond our physical lifetime.
Thought consciousness. All right. What are the top three things that someone can start doing right now to rewire their brain for success?
Start balancing the brain. The exercise I told you that I started with, morning and evening exercise. Number two, I would say make sure that you are moving your body. Moving your body is absolutely essential, and put the right foods in your system. Stop putting in the toxic foods in your system. I think that's so important.
It's communication back to your brain, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
If you could leave our listeners with just one takeaway that you're most passionate about right now, what would it be?
Get your code. Know your code. Know your specific code and live your life on your code, because it'll open up all the realities of what you want to do with your life.
Right. Beautiful. What is the stat for the brain? We're only consciously using what, less than, is it 10% of the brain?
They say that. They say, I've heard 3%, 10%. Yeah. I don't know what it is. But if that's the case, and imagine what we're about to do in the new frontier.
Right.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. I keep getting this visual of when someone is living in their consciousness, there's an instant knowing that we're all connected.
Yeah.
We're all connected. Thank you so much for today. What an honor.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so honored and gracious to be able to be here. Thank you.